All right, Alexander, let's talk about two countries and maybe three, because I think the UK would be an interesting launching pad for the two countries that we're going to discuss related to CV, and that is Sweden and Belarus. And I think that the UK kind of started with the same strategy to tackle this pandemic that Sweden is now implementing. And as Sweden is now implementing the, for lack of a better word, the herd immunity strategy. Maybe it's a little bit different in Sweden. I don't know. Let's just call it that. So Sweden is enacting what the UK initially started out enacting. Belarus is kind of all the way on the other side, where you have Lukashenko pretty much saying, just go work in the fields, get on a tractor, work, farm the land, drink vodka, and everything's going to be okay. But you did send me an article, and this may be hinting that the virus is growing or spreading in Belarus, and it's no one just knows, or they're not reporting it to government because it looks like the Kremlin may have had diplomatic communication with the Belarus government asking for help related to the city. So maybe it's spreading, and of course, it wouldn't be any surprise that the Belarus government is not the most transparent, that is not informing their citizens as to what's going on. On a side note, Alexander, on a side note, my Russian language teacher, who I have lessons with over Skype, she lives in Belarus, and she tells me that things are normal. In other words, everything is pretty much open, but the citizens have taken things into their own hands, and there are a lot of restaurants and cafes that are empty and are having troubles, and people are staying home. And she says that people are staying home because not only are they scared about the CV and what they're reading on the internet with other countries, but they're also staying home because they just don't have any information. It's kind of like a media blackout for them because the government is not informing them as to what's going on. So we have three country case scenarios: the UK, where it started, where it is; Sweden, where it currently is right now; and the outlier, the country that's bucking all trends, Belarus.
Let's start with Britain because that's where I am and that's where I'm most familiar with. I mean, we've had a tremendous seesawing of policy here. Firstly, it took a very long time for the British government to wake up to the fact that there was a serious a crisis on its hands. I mean, in fairness to them, they had Brexit to think about. So I think most of January and early February was taken up with getting, the Brexit deadline passed, which was on the 20th of January. And then they went and relaxed after that. So perhaps that's not so surprising. I mean, it's difficult to underestimate, to overstate, in fact, how debilitating the whole Brexit drama was in Britain in 2019, how exhausted the political class and the government must have been about it. So it's entirely unsurprising, actually, that all these people wanted to take a rest. But having said that, they took a rest at the very worst time because clearly things were gradually cranking up. And then what happened was that they started getting advice from their chief medical officer and people of that kind, which basically told them, this is only a medium danger. It's not, particularly big danger. What we can do is that we can track the people who get infected, see who's been contacted. But if provided we do that and provided we take steps to help old people who are the most at risk, we'll be okay. And the what we need to accept that this infection will spread amongst the entirety of the population, but that's probably a good thing because in the absence of a vaccine, that will provide us with some kind of resistance on the part of the population, which will reduce the danger from this infection in the future. So that was their policy. That was their policy for a very, very long time. And I have to say, it was a policy which would have been attractive anyway, to the leaders, the Conservative Party leaders. I mean, Boris Johnson is not a hands-on manager. That's not what he does. So, you know, if you come along and you tell him, you know, you do the minimum, all will be well, he is inclined to do that. He's not a manager. He's not an administrator. He's not the sort of person who likes to put in 15 hours of hard work every day. He is apparently given a missive, an instruction that he will only read documents that are two A4 pages long. He won't read anything longer than that. So that gives you some idea of, you know, what the mood was within the government. And I would add, by the way, that Dominic Cummings, Johnson's very powerful special advisor, is somebody who also has a kind of libertarian, anarchistic attitude anyway, and a grave mistrust of the civil service. Cummings was, of course, the man who championed Brexit. The civil service opposed Brexit. So that would have made him also very resistant to bureaucratic solutions. And then what happened was that about 10 days ago, they received the study from Imperial College, which said to them that, you know, this isn't actually extremely unwise what you're doing, because what would have happened if you'd simply did nothing is you'd have ended up with a situation of 500,000 deaths. But if you continue with the policy that you have, which is just trying to track people and taking it all very in a very relaxed way and giving sort of advice, you know, not advice to the population, not to mix too much, you still end up with 20,000 deaths and an overwhelmed National Health Service. So what you've got to do, in other words, an Italian type scenario. So what you've got to do is you've got to start to clamp down. And the government then did this massive U-turn, and they basically imposed quarantine like everyone else across Europe has done. It's important to say it's still a lot softer than you find in most countries. I'm still able to put my dogs in my car, drive them about a mile away to a park, walk them there. I'm still able to do that. And those parks are still quite full. So it's not quite as stringent as it is in some countries. And there's the monitoring that you get. You don't have police wandering around. You haven't had the army called in. But that's the tactic that's been followed. Now, what we're starting to learn is that for whatever reason, things are starting to deteriorate here. It seems that the National Health Service can't do the number of tests that it's supposed to. I mean, the government has only managed to get 8,000 tests. We've only reached a total of around 8,000 to 9,000 tests being done each day for the infection. For the sake of comparison, Russia is doing 36,000 tests a day and is expected to reach around 70, 80,000 tests a day by the end of this week. Germany is already doing 75,000 tests a day. The United States, which obviously has a much bigger population, is doing 100,000 tests a day. Britain is only doing around 8,000. So that's very bad already, given how much it's spreading. It seems we're also struggling to make ventilators and to provide our hospitals with ventilators. Now, bear in mind, Britain only went into this with 8,000 ventilators in total. We are short of ventilators. We have Italy going into this crisis had 5,000. Britain has 8,000. Germany had 25,000, and they're ramping up production. So we are short of ventilators. A lot of the people in the National Health Service feel that they're not being provided with proper protective clothing. Apparently, thousands of them are refusing to turn up to work. So we still have a soft quarantine, and we have a health service that is already starting to crack. And today we had 563 deaths. We had an announcement of 563 deaths. So here, this very liberal policy that we've been following, it hasn't worked in the sense that we seem to be in a much graver health crisis than, say, Germany, even though Germany has many more cases. The death rate is roughly comparable, and their health system seems to be standing up better. So that's where Britain is. So we've had a shift in policy. Perhaps that shift came too late. Perhaps it hasn't been administered properly. Perhaps not enough preparations were made. Now, Sweden is in a somewhat different boat. Now, the Swedes, from what I've been able to work out, have done rather more than some people are saying, but rather less than most countries in Europe are doing. What they have been doing is they've been advising people to maintain distance from each other, you know, the 2 meters distance that we're hearing. They haven't imposed a quarantine, and they haven't perhaps tested anywhere near as much as, say, Germany has. But there has been a degree of self quarantine, that this is mainly advice at the moment. And at the same time, their cases are rising. And their health system, however, is apparently fairly well run and fairly large and fairly well resourced. And for the moment, it's coping. But with a very low test rate, there is a potential that it could all go horribly wrong. Now, at the moment, and this is an important point to make, it's not the politicians, the government, that's telling people that this is what the response to be. It is the health service that's giving this advice. And the health service in Sweden is independent of the government and is protected by the constitution. And it's an institution that has immense respect and authority in Sweden. So its advice tends to be followed. Nonetheless, they're taking a relaxed line. Their death rate is rising. They have about 130 deaths in total. Their infection rate, their confirmed infection rate, is rising. But that last figure may be misleading because they're not testing very much. So we will see how that turns out. Now, Belarus is the extreme outrider because, of course, the government there has apparently it's refused to acknowledge that there is a health crisis of any significance at all. And there's now reports. Well, anyway, first of all, I mean, you know, they still allow people to meet. They still allow people to congregate. They're still letting football matches happen. Sweden does not allow football matches to happen. You're restricted now to 50 people being able to meet in any one place. In Belarus, apparently, there's no restrictions at all. And the president himself, Lukashenko, he made this extraordinary comment that, you know, it's better to die standing than, you know, be on your knees or whatever it was, die on your knees, which is all very well for him. But no wonder how many people, other people in Belarus, feel about that. And that's, I think, you know, where your teacher, her point may be a valid one. Anyway, there's been a report today in Kommersant, the Russian newspaper, which is usually fairly authoritative, that Belarus, which has stopped publicizing its infection figures, so we don't even know how many people are infected, that Belarus has now asked Russia for help. So it could very well be, if that is true, I should say the Kremlin, or rather Dmitry Peskov, who's Putin's spokesman, issued a statement. Well, he said to the media that he personally didn't know of such a request for help. But then, you know, what Peskov knows or doesn't know is something we just don't know about. I mean, he's only a press spokesman, so it may have been done at a level that he isn't informed about. But if this Kommersant report is true, then it may be that the situation in Belarus is completely out of control and that the infections are now exploding and that the government is starting to change policy, shift policy there also. You know, the problem with Belarus is that its government is very strong, as you said. It's very opaque. It's got all sorts of strange ideas. The president has all kinds of strange ideas, And, you know, we don't always know very much about what's going on there. It does have one advantage, which is that, of course, all the neighboring countries, all the countries that neighbor it, have closed their borders. So even if
it doesn't really need to close its borders,
it doesn't need to close its borders because it's been done for it in a sense. So it's
got a second advantage, I would say, which is not a very, you know, regularly trafficked.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, it's not a great hub. It's not even like Sweden. I mean, you know, lots of people travel to Sweden. Very few people, relatively speaking, travel to Belarus. As it happens, my wife does. She actually goes to the university there and likes the country very much. But and there's an awful lot about the country too, like I should stress, but it's not on most people's travel itineraries. So that may have reduced the number of people who have entered with the country with the infection. But of course, the government isn't testing and isn't approaching the thing properly. It only needs a few people, and then the whole thing can spiral out of control. So we have these very different contrasting attitudes from different governments. But the overall sense I'm getting is that even in countries like Sweden and Belarus, the direction of travel, if you like, in terms of government policy, may be to take this thing increasingly seriously. And of course, in Britain, we've already gone there, perhaps too late. Now, Britain, of course, is a special case because, of course, it's the major communications hub. We have millions of travelers passing through Britain. London is one of the great world cities. Heathrow Airport is one of the great transport hubs. So it has a problems in terms of people coming in with the infection from outside on a completely different scale from Sweden's. And of course, where Belarus is concerned, there just isn't any comparison.
Yeah, I agree with that assessment, Alexander. I think today, actually, the word got out. At least I saw it in Twitter. I haven't been able to cross-reference it and check to make sure that it has been reported there's been one death from the CV in Belarus.
Yes.
One confirmed death.
Yes.
Once again, I saw this on Twitter. I haven't been able to confirm it.
No.
But that's what I've been reading.
I saw that report also, and I also haven't been able to confirm it. I think I saw it somewhere in the Russian media, actually,
right?
Where I can't confirm it, and you know, information that comes out of Belarus is not necessarily very reliable.
Yeah, so let me take you to CNBC and what they say about Sweden real quick, two paragraphs. Mm-hmm. Unlike its immediate neighbors, Denmark, Finland, and Norway, Sweden has not closed its borders or its schools. Neither has it closed non-essential businesses or banned gatherings of more than two people like the UK and Germany. Mm-hmm. This weekend, Prime Minister Stefan Löfven said that isolating Stockholm could happen if the outbreak worsens, but that such measures are not currently being discussed.
Yes.
He had previously insisted that successfully combating the spread of the virus was largely dependent on individual behavior.
Yes. Well, this is all very well. And, you know, the Swedes are an extremely law-abiding and disciplined people. They have tremendous trust for authority. And it's important to stress that the advice they're getting is from their vastly admired and respected health service rather than from the government. So they do tend to listen to the rules. But, and I'm sorry to bang on about this, as we also know, Sweden has a very large migrant population. In fact, its doors to migrants, as I understand it, like Germany's, are still open. They're still coming in, many of them. And of course, they are not in the same way law-abiding and prepared to, you know, listen to what the Swedish Health Service, about which they probably know very little and care even less, is advising them to do. And we've discussed in previous programs that we've done the crime wave that there is in Sweden, with, you know, with bomb attacks and knife crime, which I'm sorry to sort of bang on about this, is related to the migrant population. It is denialism to argue otherwise. There may be all kinds of explanations and reasons that we can analyze and discuss it sociologically, but there is no question at all that the two things are related. It is foolish to pretend that they are not. And at the same time, it's difficult to assume that this large population, especially in Stockholm, is going to obey these regulations as carefully as Swedish people do. And I wonder whether perhaps the leaders of the health service in Sweden are perhaps underestimating the importance of that. Because, you know, they all look to me like middle-aged and elderly people who perhaps remember another Sweden, the Sweden of, you know, the balmy years of social democracy, when, as I said, it was a very coherent society. It's not like that anymore. And this is something which isn't talked about enough within Sweden itself. And I can easily see how it could be undermined. But, you know, this is a perspective made from a distance. Maybe these things are being taken into account. Maybe the Swedes know what they're doing, but you know, if they do, good. We'll find out very soon.
Yeah, we'll find out. And the other question with the public health agency is, maybe they're also ideologically driven. Maybe they have that neoliberal ideology, where they don't want to, you know, perhaps look at the immigrant population in Sweden and start cracking down on that sector of society, because of course there's always the fear that you're going to be labeled a racist and you're targeting minorities and all of that stuff, where you're kind of stuck in that ideology of
fear. Indeed. Can I just say something?
That's a big concern. And it's actually plagued a lot of countries, and the virus has grown in Europe because of that fear
I don't think. Can I just say about that? I mean, the fascinating thing about Sweden is, of course, it's moved to a dramatic degree from being a rather conformist social democracy, which is what it was in its 1950s and 1960s heyday, when it was, you know, had very different attitudes to migration flows, to how economies ought to be operated, all those sort of things, to a very, very radical neoliberal ideological position. The Sweden people imagine today the people Sweden imagine, I find very often, is the social democratic Sweden of yesterday, which doesn't actually exist anymore. So neoliberalism has taken very deep roots in Sweden's political soil. And I'm sure it is affecting, reactions. I mean, you know, the other thing about neoliberalism is that it is very averse to, strong government control of things. Some people would say that's a good thing, but I mean, it allows businesses and big corporate groups to run affairs and to make decisions autonomously, which would not have been tolerated in the Sweden of the 60s, for example. And Sweden has taken that to extreme levels. It's also been a great supporter of monetarist economic policies. So, when people say, you know, ideologically, they are, trapped in all of that, I think they are, because, you know, they've taken the ideology with, and they believe it with the fervor of converts, which is what Sweden is. I mean, they are very, very focused on this now. So it could be affecting their reactions. But as I said, I come back to what I said. I hope it turns out well for them. If it doesn't, we will know soon enough. Sweden is a wealthy country, very wealthy country. And it's got, as I said, a well-run health system. So no doubt, even if things become difficult and they do have to start quarantining and cutting off Stockholm and all the rest, no doubt they will be in a better place than, say, you know, parts of Italy are. But I mean, they have gambled. We'll see.
Yeah. Going back to Belarus real quick, Alexander, if the virus is spreading in Belarus, I'm not even saying at a fast pace, just say it's spreading at a good clip, can Lukashenko hide it from the people, number one? And number two, if the Lukashenko government has asked for help from Russia in a quiet manner, via back channels, will Russia reciprocate and provide that help in as much a quiet tone as possible in order for the Lukashenko government to save face? I mean, is that possible?
I don't think the Russians want to see the Lukashenko government just collapse, because I mean they're concerned about Belarus, because Belarus is a very important country from their point of view. I mean, it's also they have very strong sentimental connections to Belarus. It's an Eastern Slav Orthodox country. It's one of their key allies. They don't feel, that Belarus is a foreign country to them. So I mean, they won't want it just to collapse, and they certainly won't want the country to collapse into chaos. So I think they will help, but they will in return demand very strong concessions. Last year there was a big push by the Russians to see through the full integration of Belarus's economy into Russia's, and this is very much their agenda. Now, Lukashenko, as he always does, pushed back on that rather hard. And he made a big fuss about a Russian tax maneuver involving oil deliveries. I mean, what the Russians do is they deliver oil to Belarus at a lower price, and Belarus sells it at a higher price. And Belarus makes quite a lot of money out of that business. What the Russians did was, through this tax maneuver, they raised the price that Belarus would have to pay for this oil. It still wouldn't have been quite the same as world levels. Lukashenko was being a bit less than frank about that, but it would have meant that Belarus would have got a smaller cut than it had been up to now. So he was very angry about that, or at least he simulated great anger about that. And there were a succession of very difficult meetings between him and Putin, and him and Prime Minister Medvedev, who was still Prime Minister at that time. And this was never completely and fully sorted out. Now, I think if Belarus is in trouble, if Lukashenko is in trouble, if he has an epidemic that's raging out of control in Belarus, and he has to turn to the Russians for help, the Russians will definitely want to help. But they will say to Lukashenko, in return for that help, you have to sign on the dotted line and agree to various things that we expect you to do, because we can help, and we will help, and we want to help you, but we are not going to just go on with a situation where you seem to be agreeing with us, and then you push back on us in the way that you have done. I think the Russians are very, very tired of Lukashenko, actually.
And transparency, if it is growing, is out of the question, is going to happen in Belarus.
Well, I think what the Russians do is they go in and they take charge incrementally. So I think they will certainly want to keep Lukashenko there. They won't want, as I said, the government completely to collapse. There will continue to be a separate government, separate institutions, separate currency. But once they've integrated the economy into Russia, the practical realities is that more and more of the decisions will start to be made in Moscow rather than in Minsk. And eventually that will also have a political effect also. So that, with that, you could start to see greater transparency. One of the things people don't understand about Russia, by the way, is it is a very transparent country nowadays. Much more so than some Western countries are. I know that sounds radical, but it's true. You read Russian statistics, they're pretty accurate. I mean, I've never had any doubt about that. Inflation rates, for example, you can be absolutely sure of what they are. You can be absolutely sure. I know there have been some people who denied this, but you can be absolutely sure that the Russian government is reporting the number of cases of infection that correctly, that he knows about. I mean, there may be many cases he doesn't know about. It's admitted as much. But, these stories of a great cover-up in Russia, this isn't true. And this isn't because the Russians are, better people. It's because they remember how they lost control of their own information space in the late 80s, that, the government in Moscow, in the Soviet government, no longer knew what was going on because information had become so garbled and the statistics were so incomprehensible. So they basically said to themselves, no, never again. We have to have very clear information. And if they take over Belarus, you can be sure they will do the same there. So a more transparent country, a more free country, perhaps a less cosseted country also.
So sooner or later, we'll probably have a clear understanding as to the numbers of the CV in Belarus as well.
Absolutely. I'm sure we will. I mean, if this report from Kommersant is true, which I'm inclined to think it probably is.
All right. Alexander Berkers, Editor-in-Chief of the Durand. Thank you very much. Guys, if you like this video, click on the subscribe button down below. Click on the notifications bell. Smash that like button. And also look for us on iTunes and SoundCloud for an audio copy of this video. And please donate to us on PayPal, Patreon, and Subscribestar. Your donation really helps us out a lot. And go to the Durand shop and pick up some merchandise, magic mugs, polo shirts, long sleeves, V-necks, all kinds of good stuff.
Indeed. So, I mean, can I just talk first of all about our magnificent magic mugs? You see this one here. It is one of my favorites because this is such an elegant mug. I mean, it's got this beautiful emblem, which is the double-headed eagle of the Russian Federation, same as you find on Putin's mugs. In fact, I'm no doubt Putin is drinking from a mug like this whenever he talks to Lukashenko, because he probably needs the tea to keep his temper calm when he talks to Lukashenko. Putin's very good at controlling his temper, but Lukashenko undoubtedly tries him. But as I've said many times, it's not as good a mug as this one. The Durand mugs are the best. I say that without any hesitation at all. You will never find better mugs than these ones anywhere. And I am the world expert on the subject of mugs. I have been drinking tea and coffee since I was about 15 at school. I have drunk so much tea and so much coffee you could not believe. I've gone through so many mugs, you can't count them. And these, without any question, are the best. They're light, they're strong, they keep your tea or coffee hot, and they are beautiful to hold. And they are such a joy in every way. So we have the best mugs. You will find them on our shop. You will find other amazing things. You will find our amazing shirts. You will find our wonderful, stylish, magnificent, James Bondian quality polo shirts, which are just the best polo shirts you will find anywhere. And you will find amazingly stylish and practical t-shirts, like the one I'm wearing now, which is a long sleeve t-shirt. I've been out walking my dogs, as one can do, still in London. I wonder for how long, actually. I've got a nice big garden, so it's a huge problem if I can't, but for what it's worth, I'm still doing it for the moment. And you can see what a glorious t-shirt this is, long sleeved 100% cotton, like all our shirts, with the double-headed eagle of the Durand there. So this is a magnificent t-shirt. We've got magnificent polo shirts. We've also got wonderful short sleeve t-shirts and V-neck shirts. We've got hats, hoodies, and stickers. We've also got ebooks on subjects like Russiagate, Ukrainegate, Brexit, and Epstein, which you can read and find on our shop. And can I just say quickly, if I can just do a little plug for him, Paul, the person who helps us do these ebooks, is absolutely brilliant at it. If you want anything transcribed or converted into an ebook form, here's the person to go for, and Alex will tell you where you can contact him. So support us, support the Durand. We're always under pressure from YouTube at all times. You can come to our shop and you can help us that way, and you can be the owner of these great things. So don't hold back. Come to our shop, support the Durand, be the owner of these great things, and Alex will tell you how.
You'll find the link to the Durand shop in the description box down below, thedurandshop.com. And for any audio or video transcription services, Easy Virtual Assistant, you will find a link for that site as well. That channel, actually, you'll find in our description box. Alexander Merkers, Editor-in-Chief of the Durand. Thank you very much. Until next time, everybody, take care.